And now, from the mysterious studios of Skybird Radio International and imaginary stations, it's time for Radio Ace!
Amazing recorded adventures of Floating Flash Frisbone, Radio Ace. Flash Frisbone, endowed with abilities far beyond mere mortal radio entertainers, such as the unerring ability to break format, mispronounce the name of the major sponsor, not to mention the name of the president.
Jimmy Carter.
Flash Frisbone, who last month received the largest severance pay ever awarded for a jock for not even saying one word on the air, $4,616.96 from KBUX K-Bucks. As we join our hero this month, he is staring at his severance paycheck, still stunned, and he has been told there's a collect call for him. Let's listen.
Hello?
Hello, this is the operator.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I have a collect satellite call for Mr. Flash Frisbone.
Frisbone.
Will you accept the satellite charges?
Oh, sure. Wow, I got enough money not to sweat a phone call. Boy, I'm going to get out of radio. Maybe start that waterbed store at last.
Hello? Oh. Hello? Frisbone.
Frisbone.
Whatever, son. Say, this is Benson Berner over in Savannah, son.
Benson Berner? You mean Ben Berner, the owner of the Savannah ball team?
Yes, and the yacht. Oh,
say, too bad about that race.
Oh, think nothing of it, son. Well, listen, the reason I'm calling is because I've got a job for you down here in sunny Georgia.
Well, Mr. Berner, I don't really need a job. I got some money and,
But, son, we need you down here in Georgia. We're starting a new network. CWN, I call it.
CWN?
Yeah. Got the idea for it when I was on vacation up in Canada.
Uh-huh.
Heard this station up in Manitoba. See, it was all weather.
That was me.
And they played music that was about the forecast.
That was me.
Yeah, and I really, really liked it, son.
It was me.
Well, yeah, I got your name from Billboard. See, I got the ad right here. It says says you do everything.
Yeah, they give me a rate on that ad. I run it every week.
Well, son, we need you. Come to Savannah. Would you come?
Sure, I guess, but I really don't need to. See, I'm going into the waterbed store business.
Later, son, later. Listen, I'm sorry to call you collect, but I wasn't sure if I'd get you, you know. I called 15 stations already today before I found the right one.
No problem. I got money.
Well, listen, I'll see you in Savannah, son.
Okay, I see ya.
Bye now.
Bye.
This is the operator. Are you through, Mr. Frisbone?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, send the bill to me at CWN in Savannah.
Okay, Mr. Frisbone, the bill comes to $4,614.85.
What?
Well, Mr. Frisbone, satellite time is expensive, especially since they lost SATCOM 3.
Oh.
We'll send you the bill. Have a nice day.
Bye.
And so, with $2.11 to his name, our hero journeys to sunny and beautiful Georgia, the studios of CWN, and the offices of Benson E. Berner.
Son, this is where history's gonna be made. The Cable Weather Network. 24-hour-a-day weather on TV.
It didn't work on the radio.
Of course not, son. Folks want to see the maps.
I don't see the maps. Where are the maps?
Oh, they're not here yet, son. They're on back order. Hey, I hope they'd be here for tomorrow's inauguration, but they just didn't arrive yet.
Oh, who else works here?
Well, son, I've hired the best weather names in the business.
Uh-huh.
Names like Dr. Frank Field and Storm Field.
Ooh.
And Valerie Voss, Ward Allen and Albert, and George Graffis, wow. Just to name a few.
Whew.
All the big weather names.
Ooh, gosh, where are they?
Well, they haven't arrived yet.
Uh-huh.
We're still negotiating.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we sign on tomorrow, and that's why I need you.
Oh, for a weathercaster.
Well, no, son. Not exactly. You see, the audio equipment didn't all come in.
Audio equipment?
Right, and we need a 1,000-cycle tone.
1,000-cycle tone?
You know, ooh.
Ooh?
That's right. Ooh, ooh.
Ooh,
ooh.
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 No, a little higher.
Ooh.
A little higher.
Ooh.
That's it. Now, what I want you to do, Frisbone, is to stand behind that test pattern over there, son.
Yeah?
And just go, ooh.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Yeah, like that. Okay, now just go over there behind the test pattern and go ooh. And, but keep it regular. You know, a little more regular. That's it, son. Now, don't let up. Don't let up. You just stay there and do that, and I'll go in and turn on the transmitter, and we'll begin transmitting. Now, just keep it up, son. That's good, son. That's good. Just keep a little more regular, son.
Well, is our hero going to make it? Will he keep a steady tone going? Will he make it without breaking format? Will he get a date with Valerie Voss? And what about Elma Gluck? Tune in next month and find out as we bring you another episode of Floating Flash Frisbone, Radio Ace. Amazing recorded adventures of Floating Flash Frisbone are produced exclusively for the Aircheck Factory at Studio B in Marquette, Michigan.
Try and keep it a little more regular, son. A little more regular.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Imagine if your hands shook so badly that you couldn't even lift a glass of water. Well, that's what life is like for millions of Americans who suffer from essential tremor disorder. The condition can be devastating if you're a musician. And that was almost the case for guitarist Richard Crandall. The musician found a way to continue composing and performing, as Joel Rose reports.
Richard Crandall started playing guitar when he was a kid, but he didn't really take it seriously until the late 1960s, when he heard guitarist John Fahey. For Crandall, it was a revelation.
With an acoustic guitar, you could create a whole orchestra. In other words, I could play these solo pieces that sounded fine just the way they were.
In the early 1970s, Crandall left his job and his marriage in Buffalo, New York. He moved to the West Coast and started writing songs of his own. Crandall settled down in Eugene, Oregon, and eventually opened for Fahey. Crandall's occasional roommate, Mark Zorn, says his friend's guitar rarely left his hands.
He was always practicing. He was always practicing. It was just a joy to have music in the house like that.
Crandall went on to record half a dozen albums. One of his tunes was even recorded by another of his idols, Leo Kottke. But Crandall never achieved Kottke's level of fame. And these days, the guitar seems to cause him more frustration than joy.
If my life depended on it and I had to play the dance section of Be Good or Be Gone, this is how it would come out. I can't play it.
Richard Crandall was diagnosed 6 years ago with essential tremor disorder. An estimated 10 million Americans live with the condition, which affects fine motor coordination. In Crandall's case, his hands shake when he tries to write, use a computer, or play difficult passages on the guitar. It was around this time that Crandall got a job offer. A local concert promoter asked Crandall to drive a tour bus for Afro-pop star Thomas Mopfumo and his band. But Crandall had never driven a bus before.
I was petrified because I was responsible for the lives of 14 Africans. I was not mechanical. I had a terrible sense of direction, but they trusted me.
Crandall successfully piloted the tour bus from Oregon to Alabama and back, then parked it in front of his apartment.
They had totally cleaned out the bus. I looked under one of the seats, and I found this imbira, and I said, oh, what's this?
The imbira is a traditional thumb piano from Africa. Crandall's comes from Zimbabwe. It's a flat piece of wood that he holds in his hands. with a row of metal strips across the top that he plays with his thumbs. To his surprise, Crandall discovered that his hands don't shake when he plays it.
I didn't say, oh, I've got essential tremor, I better start playing the imbira. I just like the sound of it.
Crandall taught himself how to tune and play the imbira. From the beginning, he says he wasn't trying to play Shona music from Zimbabwe. Still, he was criticized, not by the musicians in Thomas Mapfumo's band, but by other Americans.
There are little pockets of imbira players around the country who play traditional Shona music, and they sort of look down on you if you change the instrument around or do anything else. But the guys in Thomas's band, they loved what I was doing. They say, Richard, play us a new song.
Before long, Crandall was performing his new songs in public. Even his longtime friend Mark Zorn was surprised by how quickly Crandall adapted to the imbira.
I didn't take it seriously until I was wandering around the Saturday market and I heard these shimmering notes, which could only have been from the imbira. As music does, it just turned my head right away and I moved toward the source and there was Richard.
Crandall's songs also caught the ear of Mark Zorn's younger brother, the MacArthur Genius Grant-winning saxophonist, composer, and producer John Zorn, who runs a record label and a club in New York City. In 2004, Zorn brought Crandall to the East Coast to record, and he recruited Brazilian-born Ciro Baptista to join Crandall in the studio. The percussionist says he was impressed by Crandall's sense of restraint.
He plays enough, not more than should be. It's great because he plays living in space. I could play in the betweens with him. The fact that he played guitar before is a plus for him because he has a harmonic concept of the instrument. And the plus, he have amazing rhythm.
Baptista and Crandall made two records together. They've gotten strong reviews and even made a few critics' top 10 lists.
I'm grateful to have my little imbira. It turns out that I've gotten more attention on that than I ever got on the guitar.
That started to change in the last few years as more of Crandall's guitar music has been released on CD for the first time. Crandall says it's bittersweet to read glowing reviews of his early work.
I used to not think I was quite good enough, or I didn't realize I had how special what I was doing was. You know, I just kind of took it for granted. So now I've got this other gift, you know, of the imbira and being able to do something with that.
Crandall isn't taking his second act for granted. He's planning to record a benefit album for the Essential Tremor Foundation, and he has even bigger plans.
My mission at this point is to calm the world with this music because it seems to be so soothing. And I'd love to play for the inauguration if anybody out there is listening.
And if anyone is going to need some soothing music, Crandall figures it's President-elect Barack Obama. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
You can hear a cross-section of Crandall's music, both on guitar and imbira, at nprmusic.org.
This is Radio Ace.
However, there may be
Radio Ace.
In the southeast where it will
Radio
be
Ace.
After a chilly start, it will
brought
be
brought to you by Imaginary Stations. How's that then?
Yes, Mark II, in fact. We're making a copy from our original blueprints.
Original blueprints? Are you trying to tell me you made the Earth?
Oh, yes. Did you ever go to a place, I think it was called Norway?
No, I didn't.
Pity, that was one of mine. Won an award, you know, lovely crinkly edges. I was terribly sorry to hear it had been destroyed.
You were?
5 minutes too early.
What?
Shocking cock-up. The mice were furious.
The mice were furious?
Yes.
Oh, yes, well, so I expect with the dogs and cats and duck-billed platypuses. But really, I don't see
they
what...
They weren't running the planet, were they?
No, but
I... And the mice were.
Yeah?
So they were rather upset that it was destroyed 5 minutes too early, so we've got to build another one.
Sorry, are we talking about the little white furry things with the cheese fixation and women standing screaming on tables in early 60s sitcoms?
Earthman, it is sometimes hard to follow your mode of speech. Remember, I have been asleep inside this planet of Magrathea for 5 million years and know little of these early 60s sitcoms of which you speak. But these creatures you call mice are merely the protrusion into our dimension of vast, hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings. The whole business with the cheese and the squeaking is just a front. They've been experimenting on you, I'm afraid.
No, come on, that's the wrong way round. We used to experiment on them. You know, behavioural research and so on.
Such subtlety.
What?
How better to disguise their real natures and how better to guide your thinking? Suddenly running down the maze the wrong way, eating the wrong bit of cheese, unexpectedly dropping dead of myxomatosis? Earthman, I'm afraid I must tell you that your planet of people have formed the matrix of an organic computer, running a 10-million-year research program to find the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything.
Oh.
You see, they really are particularly clever, hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings.
Attention, please, Slightly Broadcast. The mice have received reports that you have a human from the planet Earth with you. Report immediately. Report immediately.
However, in the field of management relations, they're absolutely shocking.
Really?
Yes, you see, well, every time they give me an order, I just want to jump on a table and scream.
I can see that would be a problem.
There are, of course, many problems connected with life, of which some of the most popular are, why are people born, why do they die, and why do they want to spend so much of the intervening time wearing digital watches? Many millions of years ago, a race of hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings got so fed up with all the constant bickering about the meaning of life which used to interrupt their favourite pastime of Brockian ultra cricket, a curious game which involved suddenly hitting people for no readily apparent reason and running away, that they decided to sit down and solve the problem once and for all. And to this end, they built themselves a stupendous supercomputer which was so amazingly intelligent that even before its databanks had been connecting up, it had started from first principles with I think, therefore I am, and had got as far as deducing the existence of rice pudding and income tax before anyone managed to turn it off. Could a mere computer solve the problem of life, the universe, and everything? Fortunately for posterity, there exists this recording of what happened when the computer was given its monumental task.
What is this great task for which I, Deep Thought, the second greatest computer in the universe of time and space, have been called into existence?
Oh, Deep Thought computer, the task we have designed you to perform is this. We want you to tell us the answer.
The answer? The answer to what?
Life.
The universe.
Everything.
Tricky.
But can you do it?
Yes, I can do it.
There is an answer? A simple answer?
Yes. Life, the universe, and everything. There is an answer. But I'll have to think about it.
What's happening out there?
We demand admission.
Come on, you can't keep us out.
We demand that you can't keep us out.
Who are you? What do you want?
I am Magic Thighs.
And I demand that I am Vroomfondle.
It's all right, you don't need to demand that.
Sorry. All right, I am Vroomfondle, and that is not a demand. That is a solid fact. What we demand is solid facts.
No, we don't. That is precisely what we don't demand.
Sorry. We don't demand solid facts.
Right.
What we demand is a total absence of solid facts. I demand that I may or may not be Broomfondle.
Look, but who are you anyway?
We are philosophers.
Though we may not be.
Yes, we are. We're quite definitely here as representatives of the Amalgamated Union of Philosophers, Sages, Luminaries and other professional thinking persons. And we want this machine off, and we want it off now.
What is all this?
We demand that you get rid of it.
What's the problem?
I'll tell you what the problem is. Demarcation, that's the problem.
We demand that demarcation may or may not be the problem.
You just let the machines get on with the adding up and we'll take care of the eternal verities, thank you very much.
Right.
Under law, the quest for ultimate truth is quite clearly the prerogative of your working thinkers.
Right.
Any bloody machine goes and actually finds it and we're straight out of a job, aren't we? I mean, well, what's the use of our sitting up all night saying they may
or may not
or
be.
Or may not be a god if this machine gives you his telephone number the next morning?
We demand guaranteed, rigidly defined areas of doubt and uncertainty.
Might I make an observation at this point?
You keep out of this metal nose!
We demand that that machine not be allowed to think about this problem.
All I wanted to say...
We'll go on strike.
That's right. You'll have a national philosopher strike on your hands.
Whom will that inconvenience?
Never you mind who it will inconvenience, you box of blacklegging binary bits.
Right.
It'll hurt, Buster. It'll hurt.
There is no terror in your threats.
Oh.
All I want to say is that I am now irrevocably committed to computing the answer to life, the universe, and everything. But the program will take me 7.5 million years to run.
7.5 million years.
And it occurs to me that running a program like this is bound to cause sensational public interest. And so, any philosophers, such as perhaps yourselves, who are quick off the mark, are going to clean up in the prediction business.
Prediction business? What's that?
You just get on the pundit circuit. You all go on the chat shows and the color supplements and violently disagree with each other about what answer I'm eventually going to produce. And if you get yourselves clever agents, you'll be on the gravy train for life.
Bloody hell. Now that's what I call thinking. Here, Broomfondle, why do we never think of things like that?
Dunno. Think our minds must be too highly trained, Magic Thighs.
Oh, yeah.
And so, Broomfondle and Magic Thighs became the greatest and most truly interesting pundits the universe had ever known, and thousands upon thousands of generations later, the great day for which this race of hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings had waited, somewhat impatiently, dawned.
Oh, people who wake in the shadow of deep thought, honored descendants of Broomfondle and Magic Thighs, the time of waiting is over. 7.5 million years our race has waited for this great and hopefully enlightening day, the day of the answer. Never again will we wake up in the morning and think, who am I? What is my purpose in life? Does it really, cosmically speaking, matter if I don't get up and go to work? For today, we will finally learn once and for all the plain and simple answer to all these nagging little problems of life, the universe, and everything. From today, we can enjoy our games of Brockian ultra cricket in the firm and comfortable knowledge that the meaning of life is now well and truly sorted out.
The time is nearly upon us. I detect a change in the computer. It's suddenly looking a lot more relaxed.
75,000 generations ago, our ancestors set this program in motion. In all that time, we will be the first to hear the computer speak.
Oh, an awesome prospect.
We are the ones who will hear the answer to the great question of life.
The universe.
And everything.
Deep Thought prepares to speak.
Good evening.
Good evening. Oh, Deep Thought, do you have
an answer for you?
Yes.
Yes, I have.
There really is one?
There really is one.
To everything? To the great question of life, the universe, and everything?
Yes.
And are you ready to give it to us?
I am.
Now?
Now.
Wow.
Though I don't think you're going to like it.
Doesn't matter. We must know it. Now.
Now?
Yes, now.
All right.
Well?
You're really not going to like it.
Tell us.
All right. The answer to everything.
Yes?
Life, the universe, and everything.
Yes?
Is.
Yes?
Is.
Yes?
42.
We're going to get lynched, you know that.
It was a tough assignment.
42? I mean, is that all we've waited for, that money?
May I be permitted to make an observation?
7.5 million years' work.
I checked it very thoroughly. And that definitely is the answer. I think the problem, essentially, is that you've never actually said what the question is.
But it was the ultimate question. The question of life, the universe, and everything.
Yes. But what actually is it?
Well, you know, why is...
What?
What sort of...
When...
Everything. Just everything, you know?
Exactly. Now, once you know what the question actually is, you'll know what the answer means.
Oh, terrific.
Look, all right. Now, can you please tell us the question?
The ultimate question?
Yes.
Of life... The universe and everything?
Yes.
Tricky.
But can you do it?
No.
Oh, God.
But I'll tell you who can.
But who? Please tell us, please.
I speak of the computer that is to come after me. A computer whose merest operational parameters I am not worthy to calculate. And yet, I will design it for you. A computer to calculate the ultimate question. A computer of such infinite and subtle complexity that organic life itself shall form part of its operational matrix. And you yourselves shall take on the forms of humble rodents and go down into the computer.
I think this is getting needlessly
messy. Down to navigate its 10-million-year program. Yes, I shall design this computer for you, and I shall name it also unto you, and it shall be called...
What a dull name.
Earthman, you must awake. Wake up.
Where am I?
You have been in a deep trance, absorbing data from the Magrathian Compu Matrix archive cells.
Oh, of course.
Come, you are to meet your masters. Your arrival on our planet has caused considerable excitement. It has already been hailed as the third most improbable event in the history of the universe.
What were the first two?
Oh, probably just coincidences.
But was that all true? That the Earth was just a huge computer.
Yes, and it was destroyed by the Vogons 5 minutes before the 10-million-year program was completed. Well, that's bureaucracy for you.
You know, that would explain a lot of things. All through my life, I've had this strange, unaccountable feeling that something secret, something sinister was going on in the world, and no one would tell me what it was.
Oh, that's just perfectly normal paranoia. Everyone in the universe has that.
Well, perhaps that means that somewhere outside even the universe, on the next scale up...
Maybe. Who cares? Perhaps I'm old and tired, but I always think that the chances of finding out what really is going on are so absurdly remote that the only thing to do is say, hang the sense of it and just keep yourself occupied. Look at me. I designed coastlines. I got an award for Norway. Where's the sense in that? None that I've been able to make out. I've been doing fjords all my life. For a fleeting moment, they become fashionable, and I get a major award. In this replacement Earth we're building, they're giving me Africa to do, and of course I'm doing it with all fjords again, because I happen to like them. And I'm old-fashioned enough to think that they give a lovely Baroque feel to a continent. And they tell me it's not equatorial enough. What does it matter? Science has achieved some wonderful things, of course, but I'd far rather be happy than right any day.
And are you?
No. That's where it all falls down, of course.
pity. It sounded like quite a good lifestyle otherwise.
Attention, please, Slarty Bartfast. Would Slarty Bartfast and the visiting Earth creature please report to the mice in the works reception area immediately?
I seem to be having this tremendous difficulty with my lifestyle.
Beg your pardon?
I'm sorry, that must seem an awfully fatuous thing to say.
Yes, I thought so.
It's just that I find it a bit hard to relate to all this.
It is, of course, well known that careless talk costs lives, but the full scale of the problem is not always appreciated. For instance, at the very moment that Arthur said, "I seem to be having this tremendous difficulty with my lifestyle," a freak wormhole opened up in the fabric of the space-time continuum and carried his words far, far back in time across almost infinite reaches of space to a distant galaxy where strange and warlike beings were poised on the brink of frightful interstellar battle. The two opposing leaders were meeting for the last time, and a dreadful silence fell across the conference table as the commander of the Vlahergs, resplendent in his black-jeweled battle shorts, gazed levelly at the Gagugvant leader squatting opposite him in a cloud of green, sweet-smelling steam, and with a million sleek and horribly beweaponed star cruisers poised to unleash electric death at his single word of command, challenged the vile creature to take back what it had said about his mother. The creature stirred in his sickly, broiling vapor, and at that very moment the words,
"I seem to be having this tremendous difficulty with my lifestyle,"
drifted across the conference table. Unfortunately, in the Vlaherg tongue, this was the most dreadful insult imaginable, and there was nothing for it but to wage terrible war. Eventually, after their galaxy had been decimated, it was realized that the whole thing had been a ghastly mistake, and so the two opposing battle fleets settled their few remaining differences in order to launch a joint attack on our galaxy, now positively identified as the source of the offending remark. For thousands more years, the mighty ships tore across the empty wastes of space and finally dived screaming onto the planet Earth, where, due to a terrible miscalculation of scale, the entire battle fleet was accidentally swallowed by a small dog. Those who study the complex interplay of cause and effect in the history of the universe say that this sort of thing is going on all the time, but are powerless to prevent it. It's just life, they say. Meanwhile, Arthur Dent has been escorted to the Magrathian Works reception area for a shatteringly odd meeting.
Arthur, you're safe!
Am I? Oh, good.
Hi, Arthur, come and join us.
Ford, Trillian, Zaphod, what happened to you?
Well, our host's here.
Host? What host?
Welcome to lunch, Earth creature.
What? Who said that? Oh, there's a mouse on the table.
Oh, haven't you found out yet, Arthur?
What? Oh, I see, yes. Yeah, yes, I just wasn't quite prepared for the full reality of it.
Arthur, this is Benji Mouse. And this is Frankie Mouse.
Nice to meet you.
Excuse me.
Yes, thank you, Slarty Bartfast. You may go.
What? Very well. Thank you, sir. I'll just go and get on with some of my fjords, then.
In fact, that won't be necessary. We won't be requiring the new Earth after all. We had this rather interesting proposition put to us.
What? You can't mean that. I've got 1,000 glaciers poised and ready to roll over Africa.
Well, perhaps you can take a quick skiing holiday before you dismantle them.
Skiing holiday? Those glaciers are works of art. Elegantly sculpted contours, soaring pinnacles of ice, deep, majestic ravines. It would be sacrilege to go skiing on high art.
Thank you, Slarty Bartfast. That will be all.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Well, goodbye, Earthman. Hope the lifestyle comes together.
What? Oh, thank you. Yes. Goodbye, then. Sorry about the fjords.
Now, Earth creature, as you've gathered, we've been at this ultimate question business now for 17.5 million years.
Oh, longer, surely.
No, it just seems longer. And then, just as we're about to get somewhere, you go and let your wretched planet get blown up, and, well, we're sick to death of the whole thing, to be honest.
Well, it's hardly my fault.
Yes, we appreciate that. The point is that we need a question. At least a question.
And we can either do the whole thing all over again.
God forbid.
Or, well, we'll come to that.
You see, the thing is, we've been offered an enormous contract to do the 5D TV chat show and lecture circuit.
What?
But we've got to have a strong product.
You see, Monkey Man, if they're just sitting there in the studio looking very relaxed and just, you know, mentioning that they happen to know the answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe and everything, and then eventually have to admit that in fact it's 42, then I think the show's probably quite short.
Right. Yeah. No follow-up, you see. We've got to have something that sounds good.
Something that sounds good? An ultimate question that sounds good?
Well, I mean, yes, idealism. Yes, the dignity of pure research. Yes, the pursuit of truth in all its forms. But there comes a point, I'm afraid, where you begin to suspect that if there's any real truth, it's that the entire infinity of the universe is almost certainly being run by a bunch of maniacs. And if it comes to a choice between spending another 10 million years finding that out and, on the other hand, just taking the money and running, then I, for one, could do with the exercise.
But I don't understand...
Shh. Hey, get this, will you, Earthman? You are a last-generation product of that computer matrix, right? And you were there right up to the moment your planet got the finger, yeah?
Yes.
So your brain was an organic part of the penultimate configuration of the computer program.
Right?
Well, yes, but I don't quite see what this is.
There's a good chance that the structure of the question is encoded in the structure of your brain. So we want to buy it of you.
What, the question?
No, your brain.
What?
Yeah, that's okay, isn't it? I mean, who's going to miss it?
Thank you very much.
I thought you said you could just read his brain electronically.
Yes, but we've got to get it out first. It's got to be prepared, treated, diced.
Thank you.
Arthur!
Hey, come on, guys. I mean, hey, it can be replaced, you know, if you think it's that important.
An electronic brain. A simple one should suffice.
A simple one?
Yeah, it can be programmed to say what, and I don't understand, and where's the tea, and who'd know the difference?
What?
See what I mean?
I'd notice the difference.
No, you wouldn't. You'd be programmed not to.
Look, I'm sorry, my soul lads. I don't think we've got a deal.
Emergency, emergency. Hostile ship has landed on planet. Intruders now within works reception area. Defense station.
What is it now?
Bats, dudes, it'll be Galactic Police. We gotta go, Wolf.
Police?
Yes, we're in a stolen spacecraft.
Improbability drive ship.
Ah, so that's how the Earthman got here.
Say, Fod, didn't you leave a note explaining how they could make a profit on the insurance deal?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to have worked.
Come on, then, let's move.
Damn, why all that fuss over 2 pounds of Earthling brain? We're going to have to invent the question. What's yellow and dangerous? 42. No, no, doesn't work. Now, how many roads must a man walk down?
Ah, that's promising. Mm. Sounds good, but doesn't actually tie you down to meaning anything. How many roads must a man walk down?
42.
Excellent, excellent.
Which way you reckon, Zaphod?
On a wild guess, I'd say down here.
Okay, move, move.
Okay, people, Bronx, freeze! We got you covered.
You want to try a guess at all, Ford?
Okay, this way.
Right, okay.
We don't want to shoot you, people, Bronx.
Suits me fine.
We're cornered.
Oh, hell, I've dropped my adrenaline pills. All right, behind this computer bank, get down.
Hey, they're shooting at us.
Yeah.
I thought they said they didn't want to do that.
Yeah, I thought they said that.
Hey, we thought you said you didn't want to do that.
It isn't easy being a cop.
What did he say?
He said it isn't easy being a cop.
Well, surely that's his problem, isn't it?
I'd have thought so.
Hey, listen. I think we've got enough problems of our own with you shooting at us. So if you could avoid laying your personal problems on us as well, I think we'd probably find it easier to cope.
Now, see here, you guys. You're not dealing with any dumb, two-bit, trigger-pumping morons with low hairlines, little piggy eyes, and no conversation.
No!
No, we are a couple of intelligent, caring guys who you'd probably quite like if you met us socially.
Yeah!
I don't go around gratuitously shooting people and bragging about it in seedy space rangers' bars.
No, he doesn't.
No, I don't. I go around shooting people gratuitously and then agonize about it afterwards to my girlfriend.
Yeah, he does. And I write novels.
He writes them in crayon.
No, I haven't had any of them published yet. So I'd better warn you, I'm in a mean mood.
Who are these guys?
I think I preferred it when they were shooting.
So, you gonna come out quietly, or you gonna let us blast you out?
Which would you rather?
You still there?
Yes!
We didn't enjoy
enjoy doing that at all.
We could tell.
Now listen to this, people, Bronson. You better listen good.
Why?
Because it's going to be very intelligent and quite interesting and humane.
Okay, fire away. I mean...
Sorry. Misunderstanding there.
Yeah, it was fun though, wasn't it?
We shoot him again for a bit.
Yeah, why not?
The computer bank is absorbing a hell of a lot of energy. My thing's about to explode.
Well, that about wraps it up for this lifetime.
Well, it's been really nice running into you again, Zaphod.
Zaglabos, real juicy gastron. Like agri grog pantry farm.
What are you doing?
It's an ancient Beetlejuicean anthem.
Yeah.
Singing it makes us feel good at times of stress.
Zaglabos.
Well, you're going to be like that about it.
It is, of course, more or less at this misleading point that this part of our story ends. Though it is in many ways a remarkable story, contains much that is apocryphal, or at least wildly inaccurate, is reasonably cheap, and has the words "Don't Panic" written in large friendly letters on the cover, it is not, of course, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy itself. To obtain your copy of the actual guide, please write to Megadodo Publications, Megadodo House, Ursa Minor Beta, enclosing £4.95 for the book, and £578,000,000, postage and packing.
If it's strange and cool music, you'll hear it on Radio Ace.
Every day you hear of astronauts so high, getting closer to a landing on a planet in the sky. I wish that I was one of them and I could leave real soon and be the first to put country music on the moon. I'll stand up on a crater and be the first to croon. Won't you come and hear country music on the moon? You'll hear it from the hilltops and the valleys below. You'll hear country music wherever you go. If you don't have a ticket, you better get one real soon. I'll be there to greet you with country music on the moon. I'll stand up on a crater and be the first to croon. Won't you come and hear country music on the moon? You'll hear country music like you've never heard before. When you leave that rocket and walk out through the door, they'll hear of me in Moscow when I start to croon. I'll be the only star there with country music on the moon. I'll stand up on a crater and be the first to croon. Won't you come and hear country music on the moon?
Et
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
From Fair Oaks, California, gateway to Sacramento, Tate Bloom writes, Dear Dr. Science, why does my cassette player eat my tapes? What could I feed it as a substitute?
Your cassette player is hungry. So many people have this problem because they never bothered to read the instruction manual that came with their tape player when they bought it. You may recall some mention of head cleaning solution. Well, this is just another term for tape player food. If you don't feed the heads, they'll eat your tape. It's that simple. The food they like best is 90% rubbing alcohol. The normal 70% solution you buy at the neighborhood drugstore just won't cut the mustard. You'll end up with a rusty-headed, hungry tape player that'll still eat your tapes. Hope I've answered your question.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
And now, the amazing recorded adventures of Floating Flash Frisbone, Radio Ace. You'll remember in our last thrilling episode. I don't think that's the right music.
Yeah, this is the same music. Oh.
Okay. You'll remember in our last thrilling episode. Last time, the music was a little more rousing.
This is the same music!
Okay. In our last thrilling episode, our hero, Floating Flash Frisbone, working for the Cable Weather Network, was given the assignment of producing a 1,000-cycle test tone using only his lungs. Will our hero make it? Will our hero keep up the steady tone at a steady pace for 17 hours before the station signs on? Will he make it? No. His best shot just wasn't good enough. And so our hero finds himself waking up in an unusual place, a hospital bed. In the chair next to him, a very official-looking gentleman wearing a Dartmouth Direct suit.
What about that line you always say?
Let's listen.
Hey, where am I?
You're in Our Lady of the Cumes Hospital, Frisbone.
Hospital?
Right.
Hey, I didn't know that Savannah had such neat hospitals.
You're not in Savannah anymore. This is northern New Hampshire, Frisbone.
New Hampshire? How the heck did I get in?
Well, you see, I bought your contract from the Cable Weather Network. As soon as I heard about you, I knew you were the guy for the job to cover the election.
You mean the election?
Right, there's an election.
Election?
And as soon as I knew that you covered the political scene for NBC, well, I just
Wait a minute. Now, you might have read my resume a little too fast.
What do you mean?
Yeah, what it says is...
You worked at NBC.
No, I listened to Don Imus on WNBC when I was in New York looking for a job.
Huh? You never worked with Jessica Savage?
Are you kidding?
Or Jane Pauley?
I should be so lucky. No, not even Tom Brokaw.
Well, with your extensive background, I mean, you must have some political savvy, right?
Well, I mean, I do know that in America, anybody can grow up to be president.
Well, we've more or less proven that, Frisbone. Now... Look, you gonna work for me or not?
I'm not working for Cable Weather Network anymore?
Fired, Frisbone.
Oh. I guess I'm your boy, then.
Good. Okay, now listen, I want to show you this map here.
Can you hold it closer?
Okay, how's that?
Closer.
Now, you see this county that borders on Quebec?
I can't see it.
Well, that's going to be your territory, Frisbone, right here. We're going to send you to the campaign headquarters of Rene Snowfleck.
Maybe I need glasses.
He's been running as an independent. His platform calls for that county to secede from New Hampshire and join Quebec. No one really knows where he came from, but he's got a lot of support, especially from the Tobacco Growers Association.
Rene Snowfleck. I think I've heard that name before.
The scene shifts now to election night. As Flash is stationed at Snowfleck headquarters, 3 miles from the Quebec border, the air is heavy with cigarette smoke as our hero files his first report of the evening.
This is Flash Frisbone reporting from Snowfleck headquarters. The latest totals here as the polls close on the West Coast show independent Snowfleck with 13,382 and independent John Anderson a close second, 13,381. Ronald Reagan has slightly over 11,000 But the last name on the board, I can't make it out because of all the cartons of cigarettes in front of the board. But I'll have those totals in my next report. So with 61% of the precincts reporting, it's a dead heat between Snowfleck and Anderson. This is this is Flash Frisbone reporting. Now back to the AM-FM voices, WGOP and WFLQ.
Hey, Chief, was that okay?
Yeah, but...
Was that okay?
Frisbone, try and find out who the other candidate is before your next cut-in. Your county's picking up national attention. NBC says they might take a feed soon.
Oh, you mean maybe I could get to talk to Jane Pauley?
Frisbone? I suppose if it was CBS, you'd want to talk to Wonder Woman.
Huh. Hey, that's a thought. Hey, wait just a minute, Chief.
Oh, don't call me Chief. What the heck's going on there, Frisbone?
I'm not sure. I'll go check.
Well, listen, I gotta check on Reagan headquarters. Get back to me, Frisbone. Get back to me.
Well, what's all the hubbub at Snowfleck headquarters? And are you sure that's the right music?
Is the right music.
Listen, if you're fooling me, if that's not the right music, I don't have to announce. It's in my contract.
We have ways of making you talk.
Tune in again next month for another thrill-a-minute episode of Floating Flash Frisbone Radio Ace. And don't forget to vote.
And what about El McGlack?
The amazing recorded adventures of Floating Flash Frisbone are produced at Studio B in Marquette, Michigan. Exclusively for the Air Check Pack.
You've been listening to Radio Ace from your imagination or imaginary stations where radio connects us all. 73.